Hello, friend. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast, and I hope you hear something truly, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, something that edifies, equips, enlightens, encourages, and then gently but firmly gets you out there into the marketplace of ideas. I so appreciate your taking the time to listen. But before you start the broadcast, let me just take a moment and explain that this month's truth tool is called SEEK, S-E-E-K, written by my friend David Robertson, my favorite Scottish apologist who is currently serving the Lord in Australia. He comes and visits with us once a month. And he wrote a book called Ask, and now he's written a follow-up book called Seek, Real Word Answers to Real World Questions. And so he literally goes through a whole series of questions like, is there ever a good lie? Or does the Bible have mistakes? Or what does the Bible say about climate change? Or what's the difference between capitalism and communism? And the list goes on and on and on. So it is a fabulous reference book that I know you're going to want to put in your legacy library. So if you'd like a copy of Seek, and we are listener-supported radio, I'd love to send one to you when you give a gift of any amount to support In the Market with Janet Parshall. Simply call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, and offer a gift of any amount. We'll send you a copy of David's book, Seek. Or if you'd rather do it online, go to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Scroll to the bottom of the page. There's the cover. It has a brain on the cover, so you can't miss it. Click on the cover of the book, make your gift right through the website, and we'll send you a copy of Seek by David Robertson. Great tool to have, one of those important little volumes in your ready reference library, and I know you're going to be blessed. By the way, when you're on the website, you might want to consider being a Parshall partner. Those are people who give every single month at a level of their own choosing. They always get whatever the truth tool is that particular month. And in addition to that, they get a newsletter that contains an audio piece from me as well. So Parshall partner or just this month's truth tool, either way, it helps us financially to keep moving forward. 877-JANET-58, 877-JANET-58, or online at inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Now, please enjoy the broadcast.
Here are some of the news headlines we're watching.
By the time the conference was over, the president won a pledge.
So Americans worshiping government over God.
An extremely rare safety move by a nation.
17 years, the Palestinians and Israelis negotiated.
Friends, welcome to In the Market with Janet Parshall and a very happy Tuesday to you. Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff has promised, quote, consequences for Iran's unprecedented missile attack on the Jewish state and added it would come at a time of Israel's choosing. In the meantime, White House leaders still say Israel shouldn't counterattack, saying no one wants a wider war. The president also renewed his call for a ceasefire and the release of the Hamas-held hostages. We turn now to Julie Stahl, also working for CBN News, also out of Jerusalem. She gives you an update.
Israel says there's no doubt it will respond to the unprecedented drone and missile attack by Iran.
Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly.
The question is how and when. Reserve Brigadier General Amir Avivi tells CBN News they presented plans for striking back even before the attack.
These plans really can be from, you know, cyber attacks to destroying nuclear plants to completely wiping out the oil production of Iran. Sinking their navy. There are so many possibilities.
Still, the White House continues to press Israel not to take retaliation too far.
We don't want to see a war with Iran. We don't want to see a broader regional conflict. We will do what we have to do to defend Israel.
We're committed to a ceasefire that will bring the hostages home and preventing conflict from spreading beyond what it already has.
Avivi says although Israel can hit Iran in many ways, there's something bigger at stake.
One of the considerations is that Israel, of course, would rather see a buildup of a coalition.
Israel's successful defense is due to a coalition that included Arab nations like Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Jordanian planes took part in shooting down the massive waves of drones headed for Israel. The Jerusalem Post reports Saudi Arabia acknowledged its part in the coalition. It's also blaming Iran for instigating the October 7th attack by Hamas to thwart normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The fragile coalition is part of a U.S.-led effort to build a Middle East alliance that recognizes the danger that Shia Iran poses to Sunni Muslim nations and Israel. In an article in the Wall Street Journal, one U.S. official said the Abraham Accords made a significant difference by allowing the countries to work together openly.
Israel's defense was strengthened by a coalition of countries led by the United States and working together.
Avivi says the coalition, which also included Britain and France, understood they could be next.
The U.S. see ballistic missiles flying more than 1,000 kilometers in 10 minutes towards Israel. They understand they're next. These ballistic missiles can reach Europe. They will reach also the U.S. And in a year or two, they can be nuclear. So we need to deal decisively with this threat from Iran and really build a coalition that will be willing to pose a military threat and deal with these challenges.
While the U.S. says it won't take part in a strike on Iran, it's committed to defending Israel. CBN White House correspondent Abigail Robertson reports that Biden is pushing Congress to swiftly pass more foreign aid.
The White House called Iran's attack, which caused virtually no damage, a spectacular and embarrassing failure, although it also made clear Iran's intent to cause destruction in Israel. The administration is urging the House to pass the bipartisan national security supplemental that already cleared the Senate so that Israel and Ukraine can continue to defend themselves.
Meanwhile, protesters blocked roads and bridges in multiple cities across the U.S., protesting Biden's support for Israel. Julie Stahl, CBN News, Jerusalem.
And of course, that provides political pressure to the president in an election year. So I want to build on this cost question. The successful defense of Israel reportedly has cost around $1.5 billion. And that then goes to the aid packages. Now, one of the sticky wickets on Capitol Hill is whether or not you amalgamate the aid packages between Israel and Ukraine, markedly different situations. I turn now to I-24. It's a media outlet in Israel that takes a look at the U.S. House now, who is reviewing the bill that's already passed the Senate, an aid package to Israel, and what they need to consider, if at all, now that there has been an attack by Iran to Israel. Have a listen.
Despite months of delay, America will send aid to its allies in need, says Washington.
We have terrorists and tyrants and terrible leaders around the world like Putin and Xi and in Iran, and they're watching to see if America will stand up for its allies and in our own interest around the globe, and we will.
But U.S. aid has been delayed for more than 2 months after the Senate passed a $95 billion aid bill, which included $14 billion for Israel and $60 billion for Ukraine. Now, Republican Speaker Mike Johnson says he divided the bill into four separate bills, which could be brought to a vote as soon as this Friday.
What we'll do is bring to the House floor independent measures. We won't be voting on the Senate supplemental in its current form, but we will vote on each of these measures separately in four different pieces. We will vote on the Israel aid, on the aid to Ukraine, on the aid to the Indo-Pacific, and then another measure that has our national security priorities included.
Johnson is facing pressure from the Republicans, which have pushed against the aid to Ukraine.
The fact that we in Ukraine have been waiting months for a vital support package, the fact that we are still waiting for a vote in Congress, testifies to the fact that the confidence of terrorists has also been growing for months. You can't waste any more time. It is necessary to really protect life, wherever there is a terrorist threat to it.
Adding a fourth bill, which includes domestic security issues, making part of the aid to Ukraine into a zero-interest loan, and voting on the four separately, makes all of them more likely to pass, hopes Johnson. A new sense of urgency was placed on passing the aid packages after Iran's massive missile and drone attack on Israel over the weekend.
Well, you can see the idea on the House side, not represented on the Senate side, is to splinter these foreign aid bills into four separate packages. And they should be considered on their own merits, by the way. But that's sometimes the chess game that gets played here on Capitol Hill. We'll keep you posted on these aid packages again, anticipating a vote by the end of the week. When we come back, we're going to take a look at an EEOC case. That's going to be very important when it comes to Christians in the workplace. And later on this hour, we're also going to help you understand that there are men out there fighting for mental health who really and truly believe that this might be a battle for how we introduce wellness back into our culture. A lot to cover. Glad you're with us. This is In the Market with Janet Parshall. Back after this. Should I obey the government? Are there mistakes in the Bible? Why is there suffering? Those kinds of questions are why I've chosen Seek as this month's truth tool. The Bible offers real word answers to real world questions. Ask for your copy of Seek when you give a gift of any amount to In the Market. Call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, or go to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. I so appreciate the work of the Thomas More Society. They have done stellar work in the courts defending the religious liberties of a wide variety of clients. And I want you to learn the story of one Daniel Snyder, a metal worker who just simply expressed, the Bible says, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks, simply expressed his religious worldview, and it ended up costing him his job. Hence, the story now takes us to the Thomas More Society, where Peter Breen joins us. So good to have him back on the program again. He is the executive vice president and head of litigation for Thomas More and a Notre Dame grad, so he knows his stuff. So you've had oral arguments on this case on April 9th, but Peter, if you would do me the favor of just turning back the hands of time a little bit and tell me what happened before June 2021.
Sure. And this is, it's Dan Snyder. He works for Arconic, which is a Fortune 500 company, big aluminum manufacturer. He's a union metal worker, and he was on his late night shift, logged into his computer. You know, they've got their standard computer accounts there, and they had asked the employees to do a survey, and on, you know, like some other companies, Arconic had plastered the rainbow gay pride flag everywhere, and including right on the top with the survey. So Dan clicks the comment box, and he expresses his opinion. You know, the rainbow is not meant for that usage, you know, for sexual gender, and that the use in that manner is an offense to God. Well, you know, he clicks send on his comment. Now, he thought he was making his comment specifically to the company. It turns out other employees could see the comment as well. Mm. Well, the HR commissars, you know, the next day, they flew into a tizzy. And immediately he suspended and then fired within a day or two later. And so that really solely, and he uses, you know, he makes a statement, not about one of his coworkers. He didn't direct his comment, you know, at well, hey, you know, I think Bob is crazy, or I think he's, you know, this or that person's got a problem. He said, my company shouldn't be using the rainbow, which we all know is the sign of God's covenant with Noah. And, you know, mm-hmm. anybody with kiddos, I mean, that's their favorite story. You know, it's got the animals, it's got the flood and the ark, and it ends with the rainbow. And so I'll tell you, we've had oral argument on this. You know, we had rough sledding in the trial court. You know, recent Supreme Court decisions have been very pro-religious liberty. Mm-hmm. So they were going to have to get around that somehow. And so the company was arguing, well, he wasn't required to make that statement. And so and the judge bought that. But obviously, if you're a worker in a workplace and you wear a cross around your neck, well, it's not commanded that you have to wear a cross around your neck. Or you might say, God bless your day to someone. Well, you know, the Bible doesn't say you absolutely must say that in order to be a Christian in good standing. So this idea of required has nothing to do. It's a new thing that they've mm-hmm. pulled out and tried to put into law. So very dangerous if that stays in law. That means it's open season on people of faith in the workplace, especially Christians, because we're really put upon against these DEI and diversity policies. But if we can reverse it, the Biden EEOC came in against us. So, I mean, literally sent in lawyers from Washington. If we can win this one, high profile, high stakes, we can really advance religious liberty. If we lose it, we're going to have a real problem.
Yes. Oh, such an important case. I'm so glad you're here, Peter. Let me go back. There are a couple of things I'm concerned about. Number one, it's a comment box. It didn't say Arbeit mach frei. You had to sign in the spot. He chose to do that subjectively. And somehow the company didn't give them fair warning that if you admit or submit anything vis-a-vis this box, it can and will be used against you. Number two, the couple of questions, just logistics. You said he's a union man. Did the union come to his defense?
Well, I believe, you know, I'll say this. In this case, no. They did not do the work that they really should have done for their member. I've seen other instances where the unions have stood strong for our clients' religious liberties. So that was a disappointing part of this particular case. And I'll tell you, you know, the depositions, you know, so that's where you put the other side under oath. And they were instructive here because dealing with the lawyer for the other side, so during this oral argument, and then matching that up with a deposition testimony from the company representative, they literally have no clue. They cannot understand that a Christian would find the use of the rainbow in support of LGBTQ to be in any way offensive. I mean, it's not even – they literally can't conceive of it. And so that's what we're dealing with here, you know, in that way. And yeah. The representative, I got to tell you, the representative of the deposition, he said, well, we don't let you express your beliefs if it doesn't deal directly with the workplace. And of course, they're plastering the rainbow flag everywhere, which I'm sitting there going, you know, you're not Disney. You know, you're not trying to corrupt our kids. You're making aluminum. So what is this thing? What does the rainbow flag have to do with your product?
Wow. Well, then again, forgive me for being pedantic here, but did the Human Rights Campaign or some other gay rights activist group trademark the rainbow? So you don't have a trademark infringement here. So they've co-opted this symbol, as you said, trampling underfoot. It's a promise from God. And rather than using it, I guess, I don't know, for diversity, but they've used it for so long, they probably figure it's just kind of like a fair use doctrine for them now. We've used the rainbow. We're going to continue to do the rainbow. In fact, more to the point, we own the rainbow. But what Dan did not do was argument ad hominem. He didn't go after a person. He expressed his concern about the use of a promise made by God to mankind to advance an agenda that stands in stark opposition to God's word. But more importantly, isn't the company practicing viewpoint discrimination? I mean, I know they're all about DEI, which is now the agenda du jour, but what happens to Dan's rights to express his opinion?
Well, and he actually said that during the, you know, they had to have, you know, certain meetings before they terminated him, although they really cut that process short. And he said, well, what, you know, aren't I being discriminated against? Where are my rights? Because, you know, I'll tell you, there is a long line of case law where employees actually are doing proper proselytizing. I mean, you know, actual speaking with their coworkers about the faith. And in those cases, the employees are protected. So really, that's why it's so dangerous that if yes. they're allowed to change the law to yep. come after people like Dan, you know, we're going to be in bad shape.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank goodness Thomas More is there. So you had oral arguments before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. My guess is, and you can answer this on the other side, Peter, that if you don't win, or even if you do and the other side decides to appeal, do you see this going up to the Supremes? I want to get your take on that. I have another couple of questions on two other very important cases. That's the Thomas More Society for you. They do nothing but very important cases. Back after this. We're spending time with Peter Breen, who is the Executive Vice President and Head of Litigation for the Thomas More Society. And they just had oral arguments in an important case before the Eighth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals because a metal worker got fired simply because he did not like the use of the company's use of the rainbow to promote Pride Month. And he made that statement and he was summarily dismissed, by the way. All of this under the canopy, notice this. And this is why these are the tendril outreaches of this noxious ideology, DEI. We've talked about it a lot here. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Diversity means, one would presume, a panoply of opinions. Equity, that's a socialist term. You can throw that one away. It means equal outcome, not equal opportunity. And inclusion, which means all are welcome here. Well, no. What we see in the Dan Snyder case is that you better march in lockstep with the company or we're going to show you the door. So that two questions. And I know you don't know the outcome and good lawyers never try to predict, you know, what the outcome of the decision will be. But win or lose at the Eighth Circuit, do you see this going to the Supremes?
Well, we do think so, and here's the reason why. The EEOC, normally, you know, they don't come in against a lone union metal worker who's up against a Fortune 500 company. Mm. So, I mean, our client is one lone, you know, he's 62 at the time of the discrimination and firing. He's 65 now. You know, who is he in the grand scheme of things? Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, and now we at Thomas More, you know, we believe in the little guy's cause. But why is the Biden administration sending in, I mean, we're talking Ivy League educated lawyers from Washington to try to crush this guy? it's because it's so important. And so we do think this is going to have legs going beyond, you know, especially because the Supreme Court had broadened religious liberty and other anti-discrimination rights of workers in the Groff case last year. We do believe in these last few years that it's important to lay down these markers right now. We've got to establish the, you know, the foothold so that people of faith can feel comfortable in the workplace. You know, I mean, are you going to be fired because you wore a cross to work that day? You know, are you going to be fired because of an errant comment or hear a very honest, straightforward comment to your company, not even to another person, but to your company, you know, saying, hey, why don't you guys respect the religious liberty rights? You know, you're doing something religiously offensive to me. And so, I mean, I will say the oral argument went really well. You know, the judges were keyed in on the critical issues of the case and asked the questions, you know, we thought they were going to ask. And we think, you know, I really do think that our side had the better of it at the oral argument. But again, you can never predict.
Right.
But I really hope, you know, we're really hoping for a win here that we can take other places around the country.
Well, friends, you can be praying for this, by the way, because as Peter said, and he's not exaggerating, this could have such an impact on Christians in the workforce straight across the board. But he makes such a salient point, which is why would you send big dogs from D.C., from my town, to go after a little guy who works in a factory? It just makes no sense other than the force feeding of this ideology of DEI. And we're going to get you and we're going to scare you to death and we're going to silence you into submission. It's unconscionable. So let me flip this around. You know what happened in Chicago yesterday. These anti-Israel protesters, they did it on the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. They did it in New York. They were stopping people from getting to O'Hare in Chicago. No arrests, by the way. They did it in Florida. They did get arrested there, but in the other big places, they didn't. So in the meantime, you're not arresting them, but you take a bunch of pro-lifers in Tennessee who are praying and singing hymns outside of an abortion clinic, and now you've got the federal government again stepping in, saying it's a violation of the FACE Act. You'll explain that to us in a minute. And these people could be facing up to 11 years in prison. Something ain't right here, Peter. Tell me about the case involving Paul Vaughn, because he's central to this case in Tennessee.
Absolutely. And this is one of those examples of the DOJ, Biden administration DOJ, weaponizing government. So we've got groups of folks who will pray outside of abortion facilities. And sometimes we've got, a hardy band of a few who will go and then sit in front of the door. You know, this is civil disobedience. So is it legal? Well, no. But is it something that we as Americans are used to seeing from the civil rights movement and back to Mahatma Gandhi, you know, over in India? Yes, we've seen it. It's an accepted method of social protest. Well, Paul was part of a group that decided to go pray and then protest at a Tennessee abortion facility back in 2021. The thing was, Paul didn't even stay to sit in front of the door. I mean, he was there really more for moral support and to help out and to negotiate with the police and then talk to the media afterwards. So he didn't even get arrested on the day of for trespass. And so trespass is you get a little fine. You know, it's the same sort of thing, that, again, from the civil rights movement or what have you. It's a misdemeanor. It's a small issue and one where you make a statement as a citizen and then you you serve your maybe you got to spend a day in jail or something like that. Instead, what the DOJ has done is they have come after these people, not just with the FACE Act. So that's a federal law passed under President Clinton trying to stop. We had massive protests at abortion facilities. Folks may remember thousands of people were sitting in front of these abortion facilities such that they just couldn't operate. And so the federal government got involved. This is the only, as far as I know, the only social movement that has been so directly had their civil disobedience directly targeted by the federal government. So not these folks that are literally blocking you from getting to the airport and then Antifa doing violent things. No, just the pro-lifers are the ones that have been targeted. But now they're not just charging our folks with the misdemeanor, okay, you sat in front of the clinic. They're charging them with a 10-year felony against rights. And so, so this is where the DOJ has never done this before. Obama's DOJ didn't do it. Clinton's DOJ didn't do it. So we've been fighting it very hard. We think that that's the case. The It's going to go up to the courts of appeals and maybe to the Supreme Court where a misuse of law by the DOJ.
And I tell you what, that is an important discussion to have, a misuse of law. You use the word weaponize, and that's exactly what this is. Peter, I have so many more things to talk to you about. Thank you for the gift of your time and your insight. Let's talk again soon. I want you to learn more about Thomas More Society. They are superb in my book. So I've got a link on my info page. You can learn more about the wonderful work that Peter Breen does. Back after this. How do you keep your finger on the pulse of America while listening to the heartbeat of God's Word? On In the Market, we look for God's perspective on current events. Become a partial partner today and keep this Christ-centered program on the air. As a benefit, you'll receive exclusive resources every week prepared just for you. You'll get behind-the-scenes intel from my email to yours. Call 877-JANET-58 or go online to inthemarketwithjanetpartial.org. If you've listened to this program with any regularity, you know that our conversations about mental health are frequent because one of the things I want to do is to eliminate the stigma associated with mental illness in the church. I mean, we have enough of a stigma in the culture writ large, but in the church, it's really inexcusable because this is where broken people come to find comfort and community and healing and to interact with the great physician himself. And by the way, if you think that mental illness doesn't reside in the church as it does outside the church, awake, O sleeper. So I was introduced to a conversation recently that I wanted to share with you. In fact, it was so good, I wanted it to have a broader audience. The message was delivered by Dr. Ryan Burkhardt, who's the Dean of the School of Counseling at Colorado Christian University. And he's very much an important figure in Colorado's counseling field. He has influenced the standards and practices of professional counseling in that state, and he's done it by getting legislation changed. His efforts are crucial in establishing the designation for counseling candidates, renewing and enhancing clinical supervision, setting minimum clinical competency qualifications, passing suicidal prevention laws, and aligning Colorado's counseling practices with national standards, all of which is excellent. You've heard me say here on multiple occasions that we have more patients than we do practitioners. And so having somebody come through the School of Counseling at Colorado Christian University, may their tribe increase and may we see many who graduate. He also serves as the executive director of the Colorado Counseling Association, and he represents about 10,000 professional counselors alongside the association's governing council. He is a licensed professional counselor in himself. He has a small clinical supervision and consultation practice. But he was asked to deliver an address recently at something at CCU that was part of the Chancellor's Lecture Series. And it really had to do with mental health. But he was also asking us if we are really seeing an increase in mental health questions in our country, and rather what we've really perhaps observed is a rapid decline in the pursuit of wellness and what he calls cultural wellness anchors. That's exactly why I wanted Dr. Burkhardt to join us. So Dr. Burkhardt, the warmest of welcomes. Thank you for who you are, what you do, particularly in the area of counseling. As I say, it's just sad that we're getting better, but for the longest period of time, maybe it's because so often mental health is associated with behaviors, and because behaviors are very much tied into what we believe in Scripture about how we conduct ourselves. And when behaviors were, quote, out of whack in Scripture, there was a demon involved or a lack of faith or unconfessed sin. And we fail to recognize that even the organ of the brain can get broken, just like the pancreas or the arm in your bone. So I praise God for people like you that are absolutely raising the standard and helping us understand the importance of real good mental health in this country, of which we are currently in a crisis. It is the parallel pandemic to COVID, and we've got all kinds of issues. So why do you think, when you talk about a decline in the pursuit of wellness and cultural wellness anchors, is that because we're seeing an uptick in diagnosis? Is it because we're pursuing the wrong thing? Because for a whole lot of people, it's sort of like the gerbil on a wheel. We're going around and around and around, but are we seeing significant movement forward? So welcome and share some of your thoughts about that distinction of the pursuit of wellness and what happens when we remove those wellness anchors in our country.
Well, I think the gerbil on the wheel is a really good analogy. In fact, Thomas Insull, who was the director of the National Institute for Mental Health for most of the 21st century, spoke to this. He wrote a recent book called Healing. It's a fantastic book on the state of mental health services in the United States. Mm. And Thomas Insull really knows this well, as he led
most of our mental health initiatives in the United States for most of the, or all of the Obama presidency, and also most of the Bush presidency. And what Insel talks about in his book, he states that as director, the National Institute for Mental Health, he oversaw the spending of $20 billion with a B, dollars in research on mental health research. How do we treat depression? How do we treat schizophrenia? How do we treat anxiety? And they learned all of these new things, but none of it did anything to reduce the rates of mental illness that we're seeing in our country. Mm. And this is such an important question for us to wrestle with. We hear all the time, we are in the middle of a mental health crisis. We have the highest mental illness rates that we've ever seen. And those are true. Those are very true. We are seeing incredibly high rates of mental illness. There are people who are struggling with mental illness, who are struggling with depression, who are struggling with anxiety. But are we actually causing a difference? Is my profession actually reducing the rates of mental illness? And at this point, it doesn't seem like we are. Mm. And we have to wrestle with that. And what I've observed, what my argument is that we need a different approach. We have been treating the symptoms. We have been symptom-centric up until this point. And what I'm arguing is we need to begin looking at what's causing the increase in mental illness. What's driving the increase in mental illness? And the truth is, many of the things that used to serve as what we would call psychological protective factors, things that used to be in our life that promote what my profession calls wellness, and we can talk more about what wellness is, but things that used to actually just be there inherently, whether it was meaningful social connections, healthy family systems, committed and healthy marriages, individual attributes such or behaviors such as social structures and habits and beliefs, all of these things developed internal resiliency. My profession calls it grit, a sense of meaning and purpose. These things are largely either gone or they're in the process of being eroded. And the result is mental illness. So when we lose the things that typically breed or generate psychologically protective properties in us, when we lose those things, we then become vulnerable. If we don't have psychological protective things in our lives, we then become vulnerable to the things that could cause unwellness or mental illness. What I'm saying is that that's what's driving mental illness in the United States. What's causing mental illness is the loss of stabilizing factors that used to be a part of our daily lives and be a part of our lives all throughout the stages of development.
Wow. So you're willing to tackle giants because this is a monstrously huge issue. You have to turn an entire juggernaut around. First of all, let me pick apart some of the things that you said because I really resonated. Again, I'm so thankful that what we're doing is we're starting to look like we do in all other areas of medicine. We're finally looking at the organ of the brain, so we're understanding that a little bit more. But you're also saying that some of those supportive props have been knocked off in our society as well.
Yes.
So let me just kind of examine, and I have the luxury of doing this with the gift of your time. When these props get knocked out, they're going to be replaced with something else. So that's just the nature of things, right? Nature abhors a vacuum. So when we talk about the lack of social connectedness, and I don't want to make this too easy, and we say this so often and then we get flippant about it, but when we introduced screen time, when we introduced tech platforms where we had pseudo relationships, where we could get thumbs up because somebody liked us, or we determine our value, our worth, and our significance by how many likes we've got, we substituted real social interconnectedness with artificial social connectedness. Not only that, but we set ourselves up for a very big mental fall. If the followers don't come, if the likes aren't there, then you look in the mirror and you see a person with no significance. That's not a small issue. That's a huge issue.
Huge.
If that is the issue, how do we turn that around? Because these tech giants aren't going away anytime soon because there's billions of dollars in them, their hills.
What I've been saying for the last couple of years now that I believe, even as followers of Christ, if we're looking for something significant to happen in our culture, I think it starts in two places. If we're looking at, let's say, decreasing significant mental illness rates in our culture, as a church, if we're looking for a new revival in our culture, it starts two places. It starts in the family system, then it starts in the marriage system. That's it. Mm. Our ability as I think as a culture, as individuals, but more importantly, as followers of Christ, to recognize the immense value in healthy family systems, where the family system is the responsible agent for the moral character, the moral development of our children. We've outsourced that to the school systems. We need to reclaim that. We need to take that back. That needs to be something that fathers and mothers are instilling in their children. They're investing in their children in that way. It starts there. We need husbands who primarily identify as husbands. The decisions that I make, the decisions that I don't make, will be made as a husband. Same thing for mothers. What we need to have happen in the church and also in our culture is, frankly, a revival of family systems and marriage systems. And if we do that, we will begin to see significant changes happen in our culture, but I also believe in mental illness rates.
Yeah. Absolutely. Wow. I'm so resonating with this. And so I'm watching, I'm fascinated by cultural shifts. Maybe it's because here in Washington, you know, there are groups that specialize in this. And those cultural shifts often have a way of coming up with ideas who then turn into legislation, which then becomes the law of the land. So there's a synergy here in all of this. But I want to go to the church for a minute. The world's acting like the world is supposed to act without Jesus. So here is where the church must lead. And that is, we've abandoned the idea of the primacy of family because I think we've forgotten exactly what its purpose and design is for. So take just a few minutes and talk about the fact that the family, if the family has an impact, if strong, healthy families have an impact on strong, healthy mental health, there's something to be discovered there. What is it about a strong family that portends better mental health?
I think there's so much foundational psychological principles within a family system. So for example, in psychology, we talk about this thing called social learning theory. I learn how I should behave from watching others. I learn how I should be from watching my father and watching my mother. Mm. Kids will become the adults they see in the family system.
Wow. Values caught more than they're taught. Dr. Ryan Burkhardt is with us. He is the Dean of the School of Counseling at Colorado Christian University and Executive Director of the Colorado Counseling Association. And I think he is really on to something. This, by the way, isn't a conversation for clinicians. It's a conversation for us around our kitchen table and our families and how we play a key role in raising mentally healthy children and creating mentally healthy adults. More with Dr. Burkhardt right after this. Dr. Ryan Burkhardt is with us, Dean of the School of Counseling at Colorado Christian University and Executive Director of the Colorado Counseling Association. I very much appreciate his holistic approach toward treating this epidemic of mental illness in our country, and that's what it is. And by the way, Dr. Burkhardt, a lot of Christians, I think, pull back because when you think of wellness, you think, oh, you're getting new agey. Well, wait a minute. Doesn't that mean, well, in fact, I'll let you define wellness and also define the word holistic, because those are words that unfortunately have gotten a bad rap, but they really have some very powerful meanings.
Yeah, this is actually the opportunity for Christianity and psychology to meet. And sometimes that can be a really hard thing to do, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But this is the opportunity we have, and it's found in wellness. And it's found even in a holistic approach. So in counseling, what we talk about when we're serving an individual, we talk about a biopsychosocial spiritual approach. It's when we're taking into account the individual's biology, their psychology, their social dynamics, and their spirituality. And it's only when we take those things into account that we fully understand the person sitting across from us. And that word spirituality actually has significant meaning in my profession. But the question sometimes is whether or not my profession decides to kind of focus on that. Mm-hmm. And this is some of the things that we're teaching students to do at CCU is how do we integrate this well into treatment? When we talk about wellness, it's very much an integrated and also holistic approach. Wellness was defined by Ort, Clark, and Connolly back in 2019 as a way of life oriented toward optimal health and well-being in which body, mind, and spirit are integrated by the individual, and this is where things get really interesting, by the individual to live life more fully. Now, the reason why this is interesting, when we talk about what mental illness is, there's one word that you will see often in diagnostic writing. It's the word impaired. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between depression and sadness? Well, depression is a level of sadness that has began to impair the individual. We've all had moments of sadness. But how much does that sadness impair our day-to-day functioning? Does it impair our ability to live our life to the fullest? When it begins to do that, that's when we begin to talk about depression. This idea of something keeping us back from living life to the fullest is central to our understanding of mental illness. Now, Insull, in his book Healing, he understands mental illness to be years of productive life lost, and he goes on to say that we should understand mental health services as a form of recovery, and it should be more than just reducing symptoms in someone. What Insull said, and I quote, it is the return to a full and meaningful life. Mm. Now, if we know this, Jesus speaks about this in John 10:10. The thief comes to only steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come that they may have life, and they may have it to the full. This idea of pursuing life to the fullest ability, to meeting your full potential, is crucial to the mission of Jesus, and frankly, even in the mission of psychology and mental health. When we talk about wellness, what we're talking about are domains of our life, and there's 12 of them. These are things like, of course, like physical health, but they're also things like relationships. We've already talked about spirituality, purpose, and community. These are domains in our life that we have to be intentional with. We have to be intentionally bringing wellness into our lives through these different domains. And if we do that, we're moving towards a state of wellness. But if we lose those things, if those things begin to go away, we then begin to experience what's called unwellness. In 2023, the Surgeon General, Dr. Murphy, he called loneliness and isolation an underappreciated public health crisis. Mm. So as we have seen loneliness and isolation increase, we've seen a sense of no purpose and no meaning increase in all of these things. This is what's causing the mental illness to increase in our culture and our society. We've lost the things that used to generate psychologically protective factors, used to generate wellness. Those are gone. Mm. And as a result, we're kind of reaping what we've sowed.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So to the people in the audience for whom mental illness has not touched their life, but they have a heart like Jesus's, they're compassionate, and they want to be a part of the solution because they've recognized that there is, in fact, a problem. What can we do to help? Because the Bible gives us the directive to bear one another's burdens, right? And when one part hurts, we all hurt. And there's a statistic that you gave in your lecture that 1 out of 5 Americans is dealing with some mental health issue. That's monstrous. If you picked up any other organ and said 1 out of 5 are dealing with this, we'd be talking about it every night on the evening news. So for the follower of Christ who wants to have a heart like his and to be compassionate, how can we become a part of the solution? Because so many of these supportive cultural agencies have dissipated, but we, it seems to me hearing you talk, could be a part of restoring them back in place again. Is that feasible? And if so, how?
Yeah, I think this is, again, the opportunity the church has. How do we, as an individual follower of Christ, begin to influence this larger issue that's happening around us that may not have impacted us individually yet, but it's happening all around us? I think the biggest thing that we can do is be intentional with community. Ray Oldenburg, back in 1989, he wrote a book called The Great Good Place. Mm. In this, he talked about how all of us have to have what he said are 3 places. Our first place is our home. Our second place is our work. But we have to have a third place. And for many of us, for many of the people in our lives, they have lost this third place. The third place is a unique space where it's an anchor of community. It facilitates broader interactions where we're engaging with people that we already know. And we're also meeting new people. This could be something like church. Mm-hmm. It could be a gym. It could be a cafe. How are we creating third place spaces for those around us? What are we doing to engage those around us and build meaningful connections? If we do that, if we focus on meaningful connections with others, we'll make a difference in their lives.
Dr. Burkhardt, I rue the fact that I haven't allocated an hour to this conversation because I feel like I've barely scratched the surface. But what we have scratched is just so radical in one respect, so commonsensical in another. and it's an opportunity, and it's final analysis. And that gets me very excited, that rather than waiting for somebody else to do something, that we might play a role in helping deal with the subject of mental health in our families, first and foremost, and then in our churches as well, which greatly have an impact on our community and our culture as well. Thank you so much. It was a superb presentation, and I'm so grateful for all the work that you're doing. Dr. Ryan Burkhart, Dean of the School of Counseling at Colorado Christian University, also Executive Director of the Colorado Counseling Association. Where there is no vision, the people perish. This is a man who has vision on how we can deal effectively and fruitfully with this pandemic of mental illness. Thanks so much, Dr. Burkhart. Thanks, friends. We'll see you next time.